From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! Back from Exile.
We violate Afghanistan's sovereignty by bombing it and taking prisoners from their warlords against whom no criminal charges have been filed, and then we violate the sovereignty of Cuba by, again, for another time over 100 years, by imprisoning them illegally there, and we violate their rights every day, fundamental rights protected by the Geneva Conventions and the Constitution of the United States.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark and Vietnam War photographer Philip Jones Griffiths.
I covered the Vietnam War for 3 years. I did indeed see many prisoners, and on the whole, the Geneva Convention was vaguely kept in mind.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld angrily denied prisoners transported from Afghanistan to a U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, were being ill-treated or subjected to torture. Rumsfeld insisted yesterday the treatment of the detainees in Guantanamo Bay is proper, humane, appropriate, fully consistent with international conventions. Meanwhile, a coalition of lawyers, clergy, and activists launched the first legal challenge to America's treatment of the prisoners there. We'll have more on that story with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark in a minute. A Chinese government spokesperson offered a muted reaction yesterday to disclosures that a presidential jet outfitted in the United States had been crammed with listening devices. The plane was delivered to China in September but has not been used because the Chinese military discovered that its interior was laced with sophisticated satellite-operated bugs. The Chinese spokesperson's comments suggest China doesn't want to upset plans for the first visit by President Bush next month. While there has not been a single word of public outrage, a Western diplomat says two senior Chinese civil aviation officials of the Civil Aviation Office have disappeared, and a senior Air Force officer who was supervising security has been detained. Two Israeli women wounded in a Palestinian gunman shooting attack died today. A Palestinian opened fire yesterday on Jerusalem's main shopping street, injuring 14 others. Police shot dead the gunman. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade said they had carried out the attack to avenge the death of 4 people from Hamas killed by Israeli soldiers. Israel has vowed to retaliate. The FBI last night raided Enron's headquarters, seeking evidence that thousands of sensitive documents were being shredded as recently as last week. Agents and federal prosecutors posted guards on the floors where the shredding allegedly took place. Meanwhile, congressional investigators subpoenaed 4 key figures from Arthur Andersen in the growing inquiry into document destruction at the accounting firm. The move will force them to appear at a public hearing on Thursday. In the wake of the scandal, consumer activist Ralph Nader is calling on Congress to pass new laws which would include stricter controls on so-called independent auditors, better protection for workers who invest in pension funds, and the repeal of a 1995 Securities Act, which made it much more difficult for investors to sue corporations and accountants. Meanwhile, President Bush abruptly changed his approach to the company that contributed so heavily to his political campaigns. He said yesterday he was outraged that Enron misled employees and investors and called for government action to force greater corporate disclosure of financial information. And as it expanded aggressively overseas in the 1990s, the Enron Corporation won an exemption from a Depression-era law that would have prevented its foreign operations from shifting debt off their books and that barred executives from investing in partnerships affiliated with the company. The exemption enabled Enron's foreign operations to engage in the kind of financial engineering that experts now say was reminiscent of some of the corporate excesses of the 1920s that led to the 1940 law and that were an important element of the company's meteoric rise and startling collapse. Had Enron not been granted the exemption, some of its operations in South America and in Europe would not have been able to structure financial operations to both conceal them from investors and shift debt off their books. Kmart Corporation is filing for bankruptcy, becoming the largest retailer to seek such shelter from creditors. The chain is based in Troy, Michigan, and is expected to emerge from bankruptcy in 2003. One of the ways it will deal is laying off some of its close to 250,000 employees. Aides to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle were exposed to the heaviest levels of anthrax ever documented among humans, from several hundred times the lethal dose to as much as 3,000 times a fatal amount, this according to their doctors. The massive exposure occurred when an anthrax-laden letter was opened in Daschle's office October 15th. About 70 staffers were affected by an exposure that set off a behind-the-scenes debate among government doctors over what treatment would work.
You see, it's getting late. Oh, please don't hesitate. Come on, put a little love in your heart. I know the world would be a better place. And I know the world would be a better place for you. For you. And for me. And me. Just you.
In your heart, Isley Brothers, here on the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Juan Gonzalez, my co-host, and welcome back again, Juan, to Democracy Now! Back from Exile.
And good day to all the listeners. This is the second week of the liberation of Pacifica Network, and WBAI as well as the other Pacifica stations.
And it's really great to have you back here in the Firehouse studio where we're broadcasting from. Why don't we start off by hearing a bit from War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
To be in a 8x8 cell in beautiful, sunny Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is not an inhumane treatment. To the extent you blur the distinction between people who are lawful combatants, that is to say, men and women in uniform, and innocents who are civilians, and you try to behave and conduct yourself by not wearing uniforms, by not carrying your weapon openly, by not carrying insignia of that, you're trying to suggest that you want the advantages that accrue to an innocent, a civilian, a non-combatant.
That's War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announcing yesterday the treatment of the Taliban and al-Qaeda prisoners detained at Guantanamo Bay is both humane and appropriate. Rumsfeld's unusual hour-long briefing came just days after the Defense Department released photographs of some of the prisoners at Guantanamo. Their heads bowed, they knelt before their captors, their legs were in shackles, their hands bound in manacles, their mouths covered by surgical masks, and their eyes blinded by large goggles with black tape. The photographs sparked outrage, charges that the U.S. had violated the Geneva Convention. Well, yesterday, a coalition of civil rights attorneys, journalism professors, clergy members brought a petition before a federal judge in Los Angeles alleging the United States is holding the Guantanamo prisoners illegally. The petition requests that U.S. authorities produce the prisoners in a U.S. court, explain the reasons for their detention, and accord them the rights of prisoners of war. But a federal judge said yesterday he has grave doubts whether he has jurisdiction over the more than 100 prisoners captured in Afghanistan and detained by the military in Cuba. Today, we're going to speak with one of the lead figures in that human rights coalition. He's former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's good to see Democracy Now! Up and stronger than ever.
It's great to have you with us. Juan?
Well, I'd like to begin by asking you, in terms of the United States seems to want it both ways. On the one hand, treating the suspected members of Al-Qaeda as, in essence, prisoners in a huge posse operation, and yet at the same time declaring war and refusing to treat them as prisoners of war. Could you talk a little bit about the implications in terms of international law about the way the government has been treating these prisoners?
You know, the United States just does what it wants to do, and it lets the implications of international law concern other people. The prisoners are obviously illegally detained. They haven't been charged. They've been in custody for a long, long time. If they're really prisoners of war, they're not. You can't question them. You know, name, rank, and serial number. What we're doing is two things. We're trying to beat them down and see if they'll implicate other people, and because the probability that they know anything is very slim. The probability that any of them speak English, that any of them have been to the United States, that any of them had heard of the World Trade Center, pretty slim. What they are is people that warlords over there have turned over to us. The pity of it is that the United States, with all of its power, I mean, look, Afghanistan is an extremely poor country, and we bombed it mercilessly from one end to the other. It was defenseless. Their per capita income is about 65 cents a day. They try to live on that. Their infant mortality rate is nearly 150 per 1,000 live births within the first year. Their life expectancy at birth is about 45 to 46 years. Their literacy is 30%. And here we are bombing them indiscriminately, killing hundreds of people all over the, and then we take prisoners from warlords and who may be their enemies or who may be people just happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, and we grill them and we mistreat them. We obviously mistreat them. We deliberately mistreat them. We want it to be seen that we mistreat them, so it'll intimidate other people and show how strong we are. What the United States ought to be doing is showing the world that it's possible to conduct yourself in accordance with principle and justice, and we ought to be adhering to the Geneva Conventions and the Constitution of the United States in the most visible and substantive way we possibly can. Instead, we're trying to give this Rambo image that you do what you want to do, and you get them down, you kick them in the teeth, and that's going to be very destructive. It's going to create more and more hatred all over the place, and hopefully it's going to cause the release of these prisoners in Guantanamo Bay very quickly.
And the use of Guantanamo specifically, clearly when the federal judge said that he didn't know whether he had jurisdiction, the United States clearly was looking to find the closest place to the United States without actually being on U.S. soil to avoid the possibility of a federal judge intervening in this situation. The fact that for foreign journalists to even to get near Guantanamo, they'd have to first get through Cuba to be able to get near the base. What's your sense of how Guantanamo has been used in the past by the U.S. government?
Well, for more than a century now, we've abused the sovereignty of Cuba. We coerced in 1901 our command that they place the substantive language of the Platt Amendment in their constitution. That gave us the right to send military troops there anytime we want to. 2 years later, we forced them to give us this, essentially in perpetuity, this right to occupy Guantanamo Bay. We had several other places at the time. And we've demanded and pursued that right consistently ever since in violation of their sovereignty. The original agreement, and it hasn't been changed, was that it could be used only as a coaling station. Ships needed coal back in those days. And it could be used as a minor naval base. This is inconsistent with either of that. Since then, we've brutalized Haitians there because we didn't want them in our country, and we thought we might not be able to send them back to Haiti. We were interdicting them anyway, illegally, in international waters. We brutalized Kosovars there. We claimed we were trying to help them, but we wouldn't let them into our country because we didn't want them in our country, so we parked them down at Guantanamo. We're using it not only because it's very close. I mean, Nuevo Laredo is closer, and so is Vancouver, British Columbia. But because it demeans the sovereignty of an enemy. It shows our power. It shows other countries we do this when we want to. It creates dissension among allies of Cuba. because they're angry that and potential friends of Cuba, because they're angry at the way the property is being used. So it's a multiple-purpose thing. It's also one of the most inaccessible places in the Western Hemisphere, and you can pretty much do what you want to do there, as we have for more than a century and are doing now to these prisoners.
Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark on the line with us from London is Stephen Solly, chair of the British Bar Human Rights Commission. You also have spoken out in Britain about the treatment of prisoners on Guantanamo, of which there are some Brits. Is that right?
We believe that there are two or three. Certainly one family has already been identified living in London. Their son is there.
And can you lay out your case?
Well, we are deeply disturbed by these events. On the one hand, obviously, we have profound sympathy for the United States and the events that happened in September. But we have long memories in Europe, and maybe longer memories than many people in the U.S. And there's no doubt at all that the distortion of the rule of law that's taking place in the United States and the publicity it's getting worldwide is going to set world politics back by a generation. And the trivializing of the issue by Rumsfeld, we find quite extraordinary, the way he talks about that these people being in the Cuban sunshine. That is really quite horrendous. And those of us with longer memories remember the way that prisoners during the Second World War, people who were taken to Germany, were told that this was all going to be part of a holiday.
We're talking about prisoners who've been sedated, chained for their flight from Afghanistan, have since been shaved, held in cages, open to the elements. What is the kind of coverage that you're seeing in Britain right now?
Well, it's interesting over here because the British government, as you know, has been very gung-ho supporting the Americans in their military campaign. But there is, I think, a profound embarrassment in this country now as to the way the U.S. is behaving over this, and I suspect that the embarrassment isn't just for this country. It's Europe-wide because, for example, we've had a genocide in former Yugoslavia, and the manner in which we finally sorted it out, if that's the right expression, is to get Milosevic over to The Hague in a properly constituted court. And he hasn't been taken out into a cage and interrogated and shot or anything of that kind. It's all been done according to the rule of law. And the dominant principle must always be the rule of law. And the escalation of illegality here by the United States is causing grave embarrassment to our government. Our government and European governments generally deprecate the use of military tribunals. It's contrary to the European Convention of Human Rights, and in no circumstances are even the worst terrorists dealt with by way of military tribunals. After all, the United Kingdom's had enough experience of terrorism, and it's worthwhile reminding people in the United States that more people have died as a result of terrorism in Ireland than as a result of the awful events of September the 11th. So Ireland understands these things, but nobody was tried by a military tribunal. And people arrested and detained for extreme terrorism in this country are still afforded their fundamental rights. And it's those fundamental rights which are not being afforded these individuals.
Well, I'd like to ask Stephen Solly. Apparently the firestorm of outrage in Europe has had an impact here in the United States, because a word is already coming out overnight that the Pentagon may be cutting off the numbers of people being brought to Guantanamo. What implications does this have in terms of the general alliance? As you say, Britain has been almost like the point nation now for the United States in many of its recent military adventures around the world. What implications does this have in terms of the of this alliance persevering over the next several months and years?
Well, of course, the reality of the alliance between the U.S. and the U.K. is that it can sustain any kind of breakdown and appear the next week as though it was as warm as ever. But I think that the European governments are finding it extremely difficult, and the European governments have an influence upon our Prime Minister. And whereas the issue of the conflict in Afghanistan was one thing. It was, in a sense, a war situation, and one had to let the military get on with it. The consequence of that military action in terms of taking prisoners, taking combatants, taking persons for questioning is something which does concern the British government. I don't think it's going to be easy for the British government to stand by, and I think they're just about holding off at the moment as a result of the visits. I think there's been one visit by somebody connected with the British government to the base, and they're just about holding off the considerable pressure that's building up in this country against the American behavior, the government behavior, that is.
Stephen Salleh, I want to thank you for being with us, chair of the British Bar Human Rights Commission in London. When we come back, we'll continue with the former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. And to broaden our discussion of prisoners, we'll also touch base in Afghanistan, where Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners continue to be held. Prothap Chatterjee, Democracy Now! Correspondent, is there. And we'll find out what's happening in Australia, where prisoners in immigrant detention centers have sewn their mouths shut in protest so that they can continue a hunger strike. Stay with us. Believe in Humanity, Carole King. By the way, Dar Williams will be joining us on Friday, the singer and songwriter. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest in studio is former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. And in our last segment, we will be talking with the great Vietnam War era photographer Philip Jones Griffiths.
Well, Ramsey Clark, since we are going to be dealing with Vietnam in the next segment, one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, in terms of one of the things that's happened since Vietnam, is that our political leaders have been perfecting a war model where, thanks to our tremendous domination of technology, that they're able to prosecute wars without any casualties on our side. Or that's what the ideal war is, one where the United States suffers no casualties, and therefore the American people really don't question very much the exercise of these wars. And I'd like to ask you, we've been seeing it through from Grenada, Panama, and through the Persian Gulf and Kosovo, and now we see it once again, where the only casualties are largely casualties of accidents of our troops over there, and what the implications are that for future conflicts in the world.
They're extremely dangerous, and your observation is absolutely right. We claim 157 casualties in the Iraq Gulf War, as we call it, while we inflicted probably 200,000. We didn't have a casualty in the bombing of former Yugoslavia, Serbia, and including Kosovo, until after the bombing was over, and yet we bombed that country from one end to another, destroyed the infrastructure, and killed several thousand people at the very least, and more than that in Kosovo itself. We send Tomahawk cruise missiles, 21, toward the Al-Shifa plant in Khartoum, Sudan, and that destroyed 50% of the pharmaceuticals available for the whole country, and the cheapest ones, because they were producing them for 20% of the generic cost and 90% of what they needed for malaria, which is the largest killer. Now we see the same thing in Afghanistan. We claim we have no combat casualties. Our helicopters keep crashing like they do every place else, but we claim we have no casualties. We bombed all over the country, and we destroyed a lot. The thing we have to see as we talk about the open and enjoyed violation of the human rights of these prisoners at Guantanamo is the United States has placed itself above the law now. It systematically violates the law. It bombs indiscriminately when it wants to. It bombs civilian objects and civilian people whenever it wants to. It is contemptuous of things like the landmine treaty, and we're the ones that produce and send those landmines all over the world, which are a form of pollution. It's contemptuous of international efforts to protect the environment. It's contemptuous of international treaties to control nuclear weapons. It's contemptuous of the rule of law. It won't sign an international criminal court tribunal because it wants to persecute its selected enemies that it's already demonized, however and wherever it chooses. It'll create a court like the court for former Yugoslavia, or the court for Rwanda, or the courts, these military tribunals, which are a joke that, I mean, in terms of law, that they're creating for Afghanistan. And what a pitiful thing, because it would be so easy for all of our, with all of our power, for us to insist that we, first of all, adhere to principle and justice and international law, and then that others do too. Instead, we're the big outlaw, and we're in the bully pulpit, so that's what they'll learn from what we do, and we'll be going down in violence.
We're going to take a look for a moment at what's happening to prisoners in Afghanistan, Ramsey Clark. We're joined on the phone by Prothap Chatterjee, Democracy Now! Correspondent, who is in Mazar-e Sharif and just went 70 miles from there to another prison where thousands of Taliban prisoners are being held. Mazar-e Sharif itself, the site of very serious, what many are calling massacre at the prison there. Prothap, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Amy. And just to reiterate what you said, and also to emphasize the point that Ramsey Clark made, hundreds of prisoners were killed here in mid-November when the U.S. bombed prisoners of war at a place called Kala Jungi, about 20 kilometers outside of Mazar-e Sharif. I was there just about a week ago. And today I went to Shibarman, which is about 3 miles, as you said, it's along the Afghanistan in the direction of Iran, where 3,300 Al-Qaeda prisoners are being held. This is the second largest prison in Afghanistan for Taliban prisoners after the one in Kandahar. And some 600 Pakistani prisoners are being held there. And just before I left, I met with the prison doctor. His name's Haji Mohammed. He tells me that of 3,300, probably half of them are sick and have various forms of, especially skin diseases. And because prisoners are kept, 6 prisoners to a room, a 12 by 12 room, many of them sleep out in the corridors, these diseases are spreading, but they have very little or no medicines to treat them with. There are a few medicines from the Red Cross, but there are no bandages, there's no hydrogen peroxide, no major medication of any kind. The prisoners that we did meet with said that they were treated well, but it's a little hard to really determine if this is the case. And question, we met different prisons. We were surrounded by 5.
Prothap, we're having a little trouble understanding you with your satellite phone. It's breaking up digitally a bit, but keep going.
So I was just saying that we did manage to meet a few prisoners at a time at about 4 o'clock today, about 2.5 hours ago.
Prothap, you're breaking up again. Let's give it one more try, and if you could speak slowly.
I'll try again. I'm hoping that you caught the comments that I made about the medical status of the prisoners, that more than about half of them are ill, and 500 of them have, you know, major problems, especially skin problems, because they're kept 6 prisoners to a room in a 12-12 room. Many sleep outside in the corridors. This is something that the prison doctor told us, and when we met the prisoners, we were accompanied by 5 prison guards who listened to every question. Obviously, they reported they were being treated very well. It's questionable as to how well they're actually being treated. And in fact, the translator that accompanied us told us the prisoners that we interviewed were in fact the same prisoners that brought out to meet other journalists he had in fact translated for the same prisoners in the past. So this is, it's hard to determine, especially because there's no independent way to verify exactly what's happening in the prison.
Well, thank you very much, Prothap, for joining us, again, speaking to us from Mazar-e Sharif, site of a prison massacre that took place a couple months ago, now talking to us about Shin Bagan, a prison about 70 miles from there, with close to 3,500 Taliban prisoners, as you heard him say, very tough to get access to those prisoners. And we will follow up in the coming days on Prothap. And before we go back to Attorney General Ramsey Clark, another report. This is the fallout of the bombing of Afghanistan. As many as 40 Afghan asylum seekers in Australia are on hunger strike in protest of the conditions at refugee camps. Some sewed their lips together last week to protest being held in the outback at one of Australia's largest and harshest detention camps. The protesters say that 500 detainees, mostly Afghans, have refused water and food despite temperatures of more than 105 degrees. The remote Woomera Detention Center in South Australia is confirming that more than 100 prisoners, about 186 detainees, 30 of them minors, are refusing to eat. The Australian government threatened to remove the children of some asylum seekers after four boys were taken to the hospital to have stitches removed from their mouths. Most of the unauthorized boat people travel to Australia from the Middle East via Indonesia. But after the Taliban's collapse last month, the Australian government abruptly stopped processing asylum applications from Afghans, arguing it needed to assess the new situation in Afghanistan. Amnesty International has condemned the freeze, which has left hundreds of Afghans detained behind barbed wire in Australia's six detention centers. We're going to go now to Marion Lee, who's a spokesperson for the Refugee Council of Australia. She spoke to Free Speech Radio news correspondent Rachel Maher yesterday in Sydney, describing the situation.
Over the last week, the situation there has deteriorated very seriously from an initial group of about 20 people who started on a hunger strike. It's now extended up into many more than that. The numbers I was given 2 days ago were that it had actually extended to 500. The department would play those figures down a little bit and say that it's not quite that serious. But last night, numbers of people were taken to hospital by ambulance. Again, the figures are a bit, you know, they differ depending on who's telling the story, but basically over 20 people were taken by ambulance to hospital in various stages of distress, some of them from drinking detergent or other substances. And some people were taken earlier, some children earlier in the week suffering from dehydration, which came about from them having their lips sewn together. Now, again, the degree to which people have been, engaging in this self-mutilation is varies, allegedly from some people with just one stitch, a large one, in their upper and lower lip, to some who've got more than one stitch. But whatever it is, it's pretty horrendous. And, of course, people are now, you know, in various stages of collapse and exhaustion, dehydration.
Marion Lee, spokesperson for the Refugee Council of Australia, describing the situation of close to 200 mainly Afghan refugees who are now being held in one of the most remote detention centers in South Australia, the Woomera Detention Center.
Well, Ramsey Clark, I'd like to ask you, given this information, clearly the New York Times today has a front page article about the focus of the Pentagon now on Indonesia as a growing base for Al-Qaeda fighters. And it seems that already that's the trial balloon that I'm sure the network Evening News will be reporting on it this evening of the possibility of a U.S. involvement in Indonesia. What's your reaction to finding out that there are so many Afghans already being detained in Australia and this focus on Indonesia?
Let me say we have to watch what happens to prisoners constantly. We can't forget them. And as an illustration of the horror, and there are 120,000 basically young male Hutus imprisoned in Rwanda today, a country of about 7 million. They've been held overwhelmingly since 1994. They die at a rate of 3 or 4 a day. Nobody pays any attention. The conditions there are absolutely unbearable humanly. You or I wouldn't last in those prisons a week of. They're not really prisons here. They're shacks where they jam them in. They're 15 square feet per floor space, and no good water, no food, nothing. We have to pay attention to prisoners. We have to pay attention to the use of them. Indonesia may be our next target. The fact is, though, that we're threatening people all over the world. We constantly threaten, and more than that, attack Iraq. We arrogantly say we're going to take that government out. We may not do it now, but we're going to do it. And you keep them on edge that way. That's not civilized talk. That doesn't lead to peace. Indonesia, of course, is a huge population, a huge country, and a very diverse population and extremely volatile. And to try to go into control Indonesia would be as crazy as going into Afghanistan and trying to control it. You can't do it. It's not controllable except over a long period of time and by humane efforts. You can't do it by force or violence. All you're doing is conditioning them to greater force and violence. So unless our people stand up on these prisoner issues, unless our people stand up on the use of technology against life around the world where we don't have casualties, and unless they stand up against the United States militarism, threatening and attacking people wherever it wants to and whenever it wants to, there's going to be a very, very miserable century ahead of us, and it's our responsibility because we live here.
Speaking of U.S. militarism, it seems in the case of Indonesia, what this allows to suddenly say this is where al-Qaeda is for the U.S. to end the sanctions, the end to the military sanctions against Indonesia for its human rights abusing military, so that they can now just shore up and cement the relationship once again with the Indonesian military.
That's an important point. We use this to accomplish other purposes wherever we want to as our excuse.
But before you go, Ramsey Clark, I wanted to ask you about one of your clients on another issue, and that she is Lori Berenson. Yesterday, Peru's Supreme Court heard the appeal of Lori Berenson, who was sentenced to 20 years in jail. What happened yesterday, and what are you expecting? You've been to visit her there.
Well, we say they heard the appeal, but would you consider 5 minutes to be hearing the appeal of a history that goes back to 1995 and a trial this time that they're reviewing that took place over a period of more than, August to March to June of the year before last and last year? It was a very short argument in which the government simply said they didn't know the case. I mean, they didn't know the facts, that the lawyers who didn't. They're changing the government down there. But they simply said she had a fair trial and the conviction was supported by the evidence. And we tried to show that this is a continuum, really, of Fujimori Montesinos' persecution of a very courageous American because she cared about the poor there and because she wanted to see a better life for Peruvians, and because, above all, perhaps she was nonviolent, and that's a weapon they can't resist.
So has the court made its decision on whether to
annul,
reduce, or
no? They're supposed to make a decision within 15 days, and the expectation is they'll make one very quickly. That's the Peruvian expectation, but they don't pay much attention. They were supposed to have decided this case last July. Their law required them to decide it last July, and here we are in January of the next year, and Lori Berenson, who ought to be free and is innocent and went there because she cared more about the well-being of others than herself, remains in prison.
We understand also that she was sexually abused along with a number of other women prisoners when guards came in the middle of the night to the Lima prison where she was being held and moved them to another prison.
The government there still calls that routine. What they did on a complaint that had been pending for 2 months, in which the justice minister said a month earlier she was going to be moved, they came in at 3:15 in the morning. They threw gas canisters into cells you couldn't get out of, small cells, which is very dangerous. Lori lost consciousness. She was taken and fondled sexually, although she was unconscious, and hit a couple of times. She hit the floor. You can't tell which it was, and she doesn't know. She was transported without shoes, without glasses, without medicine, and in exactly what she was sleeping in when they crashed in, which is a T-shirt and short pants. And she was transferred 300 or 400 miles without any of her property under those circumstances. And they call that normal. And normalcy is not so good as Herbert Hoover and others said it was.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. When we come back, we're going to, interestingly enough, be joined by a Vietnam-era photographer, probably filming in Vietnam right around the time you were Attorney General of the United States under Lyndon Johnson. We've been speaking with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who is part of the coalition of human rights groups that is challenging the U.S. military's treatment of Taliban and al-Qaeda prisoners now being held at Guantanamo Bay. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for coming into the studio. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
This is a time in for peace. 60 seconds to remember to breathe. Take a deep breath right now. For 1 minute, you can stop the world around you and follow your breath into the place of harmony within. As your heart continues to beat, allowing you another moment to live and love, smile into the infinite glowing place of quiet. Take another deep breath and follow that breath into your heart and feel 6 billion other hearts beating to the same rhythm, the rhythm of breath, the rhythm of life as human beings sharing the same earth. Take one more deep breath and smile the love of the one heart out into our world.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, I'm looking at a photograph right now of 12 Vietnamese men being marched through a field. They're walking in a line close and bunched, and by the look of it, they're prisoners. Some are in shorts, others shirtless, some are barefoot, almost all are under the age of 25, all being pulled, it seems, by a rope that's attached to the collar around each of their necks. The collar looks painful because a number of men are gripping at their necks, their faces tight and pinched. Only a few of the men are looking into the camera. One of these is a guard, a cigarette dangling from his mouth. He stands at the head of the line, clutching his throat, his face also pinched, mocking the prisoners. Well, this picture was taken by the photographer Philip Jones Griffiths more than 30 years ago. Taken during the war in Vietnam, stands out sharply against today's photos of the war in Afghanistan. Nowadays, the United States keeps careful watch over who and what reporters are allowed to photograph, as well as where and when they're allowed to publish them. It's a game that even employers have begun to play. On October, CNN chair Walter Isaacson ordered his staff to balance images of civilian devastation in Afghanistan with reminders that the Taliban harbors murderous terrorists. But during Vietnam, photographers were granted an access and freedom that seems to be unknown today. Photographers like Philip Jones Griffiths were able to immerse themselves in the country, recording not only the horrors of war, but also the texture of a society that was rapidly disappearing. In 1971, Philip Jones Griffiths published the book Vietnam Inc., a classic of photojournalism that brings the war abroad home to Americans. Through more than 250 photographs, it helped shift the tide of public opinion, fueling a movement that ultimately brought the war to an end. The book has been republished 30 years later with a new foreword by Noam Chomsky. Vietnam Inc., Philip Jones Griffiths, its author, photojournalist, joining us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, your work is astounding. You spent years in Vietnam. You're a magnum photographer. And you not only showed the war, but you lived closely with and documented the Vietnamese people themselves and their own culture. What is the role of a photographer in war?
Well, the more traditional role is to take what we call bang-bang pictures, showing the immediacy of people being killed and the people who are killing them. Certainly, I covered that aspect of the war, but in the case of Vietnam, I thought a much more interesting story was the way in which one culture was trying to submerge another culture. And I felt that the more I got to know the Vietnamese, that I felt America should be emulating them rather than killing them. And I tried to set out this thesis, if you like, my discoveries, in a book which summed up the absolute horror of what was happening in that war.
The title, Vietnam Inc., one of the things I noticed in the photography and in the book is that you focused a lot on, in essence, the war as a business. You at one point in the text it mentions that that servicing the U.S. military was the largest industry in Vietnam, and many of the shots are of the soldiers in other than combat situation. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes. I think one of the feelings was always that the soldiers should be made to feel at home. And in the early days of the war, drinking water was actually shipped from California to Vietnam. This was effort was made redundant when Coca-Cola opened a small plant which required clean water, and therefore they were able to drink Vietnamese water. Certainly, things like ice cream were delivered to troops in the field. One or two hardened sergeants would tell me that it was very useful. They used to put the ice cream in their helmet and put their feet in to sort of keep their feet well and cool. But there were many of these incongruities about the war. The musicians, the Donut Dollies, that whole USO teams that were sent out to keep the troops amused. Essentially, the single biggest problem about the Vietnam War from the military point of view was that you had to expose soldiers to something which they rather liked. They rather liked the Vietnamese. There was that sort of feeling that, why are we here? Why are we killing these people? The most dedicated military people I found were the pilots on the aircraft carriers who flew and bombed the Vietnamese without ever seeing them. They had no problem sleeping at night. But the men on the ground, there was always that feeling that we shouldn't really be here. And I think those letters that those people wrote home to the towns and cities of America, to their parents, to their wives, brothers and sisters, some of those views were expressed, and that fueled the anti-war movement.
We're talking to Philip Jones Griffiths. I'm looking at a photograph from Vietnam Inc. of a man burned by napalm. And you write throughout the book, in this you say the most effective anti-personnel weapon, it's euphemistically described as unfamiliar cooking fluid by those apologists for American military methods. They automatically attribute all napalm cases to domestic accidents caused by the people using gasoline instead of kerosene in their cooking stoves.
Yeah, and I go on to say it was indeed unfamiliar cooking fluid. It came through the ceiling. There was an Orwellian overview of the way in which language was used in Vietnam, and the terms that we used to try to cover up some of the worst horrors, like napalm, which really is the most awful thing imaginable. To describe it as unfamiliar cooking fluid was extremely distasteful, to say the least.
In terms of the access that you had and journalists had to the combat, to the troops, to the civilian population, which basically the current generation of journalists really have no knowledge of because they're so used to the Grenada situation, the Persian Gulf situation, and now the Afghan situation, where the journalists are only allowed in when all of the worst excesses have already occurred.
Absolutely. Indeed. However, you know, I think that one must remember that the access we got in Vietnam was based on a very simple premise. 95% of the journalists there were very pro-war. About 4.999% were possibly critical only of the way in which the war was being fought, not in
they were not morally opposed to the war. And then there was me and a couple of French guys. I mean, in other words, there were very few journalists who, from the very beginning, said there is something wrong about this war. It stinks. It is a genocidal war. It is immoral. Few people felt that way. Therefore, why not give the press all those facilities? Because they came back home and they wrote stories which essentially said, we're doing well. Think of 67 when the press were responsible, played beautifully by Hanoi, by the way, putting out the message that the war was being won. Hanoi wanted Americans to think that, so that when in the beginning of 68 they had the Tet Offensive, Americans would be so deeply shocked. I see a parallel between the way in which Arabs in general in the media here have been portrayed as stupid. And then, of course, they do something requiring the skill and preparation of the terrible tragedy at the World Trade Center. So I think that the experience in Vietnam was that the Hanoi did indeed sort of, as it were, prime the American population for that attack in the beginning of 68.
Philip Jones Griffiths, you, when you were in Vietnam, you were absolutely broke. It was hard for you to get your photographs out of civilian casualties.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's the thing we forget, you see, is that nobody wanted to see these pictures because it was much later on the press followed.
There was
public
no
opinion.
Al Jazeera then, so.
Well, true. It was the press that followed public opinion. It was public opinion that led the anti-war movement, not the press.
But you did get some financial support that let you take some of the most devastating pictures of Vietnam when you went to cover Jackie Kennedy and was the only journalist there as she was being courted by someone they thought she would ultimately marry.
I know. It's one of the things I have to live with. I just wish the world wasn't like that. I was born into this world. I found it, and I found that people are fascinated by presidents, ex-presidents' wives. I mean, it was one of those. I suppose some good came of it in the end, because at least I was able to continue and finish the book. But I wish it hadn't been that way.
In terms of the, did you find that, for instance, working for Magnum as an independent service and selling photos all around to various publications, did you find that there was more reception in Europe to your photographs than there was in American publications?
Well, yes, but you know, you have to split Europe up. In Britain, absolutely not. But in France, yes, they were more sympathetic. I think for a very obvious reason, Vietnam was an ex-French colony, and they had a connection with the place, and they were fascinated by it. But in general, certainly in Britain, no. There was very little stomach for criticizing the war.
And in terms of the relationships you developed with the soldiers in the field, because clearly, as you said, you were one of the few journalists who opposed the war, how were you able to get such intimate photographs of their lives, their everyday routines, and some of the atrocities committed? For instance, you talk about the enormous atrocities committed by American troops on dead soldiers and on dead civilians.
Yeah, well, the first thing I did was I had a rule. I never lied. I never try to present myself as someone other than who I was. And I think there's a certain amount of respect for that. Of course, you get into arguments. But you see, that's the point. What I discovered is that the fighting man, the ordinary GI, was, to say the best, confused. And many of them were committedly against the war. And that never, it never worked against me. And I suppose being British also helped, because when they could understand me talking, they thought I was very funny. And I just got on with them. I've never really criticized the fighting man. Of course, there are exceptions, and many guys were driven to do things they were ashamed of later. But it was the people back in Washington, I think, that were the target of my book.
We're talking to Phillips Jones Griffiths. His book is Vietnam Ink, one of the most devastating books, a collection of photographs from the war in Vietnam. While a lot of your pictures didn't get shown through the war, the book puts them together, showing photographs we never got to see during the war.
Well, indeed, yes. And it was it came out. I had a problem. You know, do you wait for a war to end before you do a book? Well, that was not possible. So the book came out in 71, and it did play. I think it played an important role simply because it brought everything together. The loose ends were brought together. And Nixon, as you know, had attempted to divert energy away from the anti-war movement by starting Earth Day, the Green Movement. The beginning of the book, I explain how the Vietnamese live in complete symbiosis with their environment, so that I think a lot that touched a lot of people. The mail I got after the book was published, a lot of that emphasized, my God, you know, we're killing the wrong people.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. This is part one of the interview we will do with you. The book is Vietnam Ink. Phillip Jones Griffiths is our guest, one of the great war photographers. They are not only documenting the killing, but documenting a culture that was being wiped out by this war, and that was Vietnam. Thank you very much for being here. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, with help from Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. If you want to email us, send us mail at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Our website is democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Juan, I'm still trying to get used to seeing you next to me here at the Firehouse Studio after a year of your incredible struggle with the only independent media network in this country, which does seem to be, well, regained. And we may well be on the road to the democratization of this fine and historic network begun by a pacifist.
Yes, we only have the problem of about a $3 or $4 million debt now that we have to overcome, but we'll do that.
Well, with fine programs and listeners like we have all over the country, I know we can do it. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!